Good afternoon. So, before the break, we were finishing up talking about return-oriented programming. We went over some, important practical issues that are going to come up on our assignment that's due Friday. So one is that we have to find our gadgets in the program. So we mentioned that there's tools to do this. It's fairly automatable. We basically figure out, well, what are the opcodes, that the machine code for instructions that could end a gadget, because all our gadgets need to end with going to another gadget. So we have these chains of gadgets. So we need something to chain together. Our most common way of chaining gadgets together was returns. So we can look for the opcode for return, and it turns out on x86 there's some bonus versions of return. So we look for all of those. And then we just go a few bytes before that and see, what that disassembles to. And we can use this to enumerate what the gadgets are. We saw that we have a utility which, just does this and sorts the results. And we mentioned that some smarter utility could do something better than that of, let you search for gadgets that, modify a certain register or something like that. By doing a little extra effort to look at that assembly. And we mentioned that these tools, we have heuristics for finding kind of automatic chains. And a reason why this idea works is that, it seems like we have to sort of scrounge around the program for gadgets. But in a big program, there's a high probability that we can kind of rely on a particular gadget being there, or something very, or one of several variations of that gadget. And using this idea, we saw that the program that you're going to use most likely for the ROP assignment, just made a chain automatically without doing anything super clever. It just said, I'm going to look for one of these, five different versions of this pattern, and in a big program, we'll probably find it. And just have a canned technique of putting them together, not doing anything super smart about that. And you mentioned that if we were doing something smart, we could make better use of cases where, as sometimes happens, we have a very limited selection of gadgets, either because the way as our programs are compiled, there aren't many things next to returns. We mentioned that you could try to engineer that situation, or because we have some very restriction on what we can input. So a problem with using our gadgets is often when we have a buffer overflow or similar, we have to avoid certain bytes that would be part of our gadget addresses that we have to input somehow. Then we talked about applying this return-oriented programming technique to non-stack overflows. And this is kind of the dominant technique for exploiting memory bugs today, because most people have turned on write X or execute or DEP or all these other names we saw for that idea. Basically just that we can mark memory non-executable. Let's do that when we can. And this means that we need to do code reuse. We have that our modern exploits for a typical program, we can't write shell code and just run it. We have to start out by running code that already exists in the application using this idea. And this applies even when the way we're starting running our code isn't through a return. And this kind of poses a problem for this return-oriented programming technique, because it's not so clear how to chain gadgets together when we aren't starting with a return. When we're starting with a return, the return would read the next thing on the stack, and if we could overwrite the return address, we can usually overwrite the next thing on the stack the same way. That's kind of free. But when we're not overwriting the return address, we have the example of overwriting a V table pointer or a procedure linkage table pointer, we have to do something else. And we kind of saw two strategies for this. So one strategy is we can look for gadgets that let us set the stack pointer to something we control, copy, a register that is set based on our input to RSP, and then keep going, and then we can use normal return-oriented programming gadgets, or we can try to construct a chain where we don't actually use return, that instead we look for gadgets that end in jumps or calls, and we have to think very carefully about, well, how do we set whatever registers or whatever those jumps or calls use? But that's, you know, in a large enough program, we're going to have a collection of gadgets that lets us do that, most likely. And that gave us this idea of so-called jump-oriented programming, where we basically look for a gadget that jumps based on something that kind of looks like an array lookup, where we can kind of increment our pointer in that array. And we can use a similar idea to return-oriented programming, even though we're using kind of jump-based gadgets instead of return-based gadgets. And we finished up by talking about kind of one of the more remarkable things in this area, sort of the Stanford paper on so-called blind return-oriented programming, where the idea is, you know, demonstrating what you can do without very program-specific knowledge. And what they did in that paper is that they started with this idea that we have a Stack Overflow somewhere, and the Stack Overflow kind of gives us everything we need if we make some kind of relatively basic assumptions, you know, that we know our programs, say, on a Linux system and compiled like typical Linux programs are. And the first thing that they took advantage of, they said, is, well, we have this idea of stack reading, that we have an information leak through our buffer overflow. That's also what we use to do the exploiting later. But it's an information leak because if we just overflow with random stuff, if we change something on the stack that was important, the program will crash. And we can detect that, and we can use that to like read the stack canary effectively and read the old return address. And they extended this technique to say, well, we can actually use this kind of idea of guess something and see what happens to look for gadgets. And we can kind of do this systematically, where we look for gadgets that crash or hang the program and use that to like bootstrap figuring out, well, we have some mystery gadget here. What stuff does it pop from the stack? Well, does it chain to the cat crash or hang gadget? Is something we can figure out. And they relied on kind of two very safe assumptions about what the program would look like, even though they didn't know any of the specifics. One was that we'd have some function epilogue that does lots of pops, and in fact, lots of pops in a particular order, because that's how the compiler works. The compiler allocates registers in a particular order, typically, because why would you randomize that? That doesn't make your compiler easier to write. And also, there was a procedure linkage table with a bunch of stubs. And just knowing those two things, they figured out a way of relatively consistently sort of exploiting a program that they didn't have the machine code for. So questions on the things we covered last time? Okay, so I'm going to do some logistics-y stuff. So I had some time to look over submissions to assignments. So on the overflow assignment, there were some people who weren't overflowing the buffer enough to overwrite the return address. If that's you and you don't understand what was going wrong, you should talk, because this is going to be very important on this week's assignment, if nothing else. Some students tried to do it using an ROP chain. I saw some good-looking techniques attempts at that. Some where there was confusion that if I have a function here and then here, if you want an ROP chain that pops things, you want the pointer here, not just at the beginning of the function, because the function's going to do other things that mess up those pops, like push the things that it's popping with. Someone had trouble with WSL. So I am testing these assignments on a real Linux system like Portal. Apparently WSL doesn't, at least some versions of it, don't let you disable executable stacks, which would obviously cause a lot of problems during that assignment. The reason executable stacks would have worked with the executable we gave you is that on Linux, you can mark that you need an executable stack in the program. And that is done in the program we gave you. Okay. And so questions on past assignments generally? Okay. And some scheduling notes. So the upcoming assignment, as I mentioned, return-oriented programming is this week. Then I have a use after free assignment, so we're going to talk about that. So this idea is, we've talked so far about dealing with memory bugs that affect global variables, or more likely the stack. But we know a lot of programs really just allocate things with malloc and new and things like that. Talk about like how can you exploit that, and it kind of seems like a challenge right now because malloc seems like it's kind of random what addresses you get. How could that be consistently useful? We'll talk about that. Then my sort of tentative plan for assignments, I might change these depending on coverage, is I'd like to add an assignment on using Rust, which means I'm going to have to write some new lecture material to support that. I have an assignment draft that I showed to the TAs. The idea of that assignment is we're going to have some code which has a use after free bug, and your job is to convert it to use quote unquote safe Rust, which should incidentally get rid of that use after free bug. And we'll start with some Rust code that uses the unsafe escape hatch in Rust that you need to remove the escape hatch from and use these features that are supposed to keep our programs from having use after free type bugs, as well as like normal overflows. But preventing normal overflows is kind of trivial. It's just that we don't do it because it's slow, right? You can just keep the size and check it. And we'll talk more about that later, probably. Then I have a fuzz assignment. So I think you learned briefly about fuzz testing in 3710. This assignment, we would be using a quote-unquote white box fuzz testing tool. So this is not going to generate random inputs. It's going to generate semi-random inputs, but it's going to figure out which inputs to explore by looking at what the program actually does. And then I'm planning on doing an assignment on sandboxing where we'll use setcomp, which is the Linux system call filter. So if you've learned about system calls in CSO2, you know what that is. If not, we'll talk later. And the goal of that assignment will be I will give you an insecure library, and your job is to run that insecure library in a way where when it's exploited, it doesn't do anything dangerous. But you aren't going to be allowed to modify the library itself. Kind of reflecting the reality of, like, I have running a web browser, and here's my video decoding library. I sure don't want to debug that, but I still need to use it. And on kind of topics, so today we're going to talk a bit about the heap and topics related to that. And then in some order, my plan is to talk about doing bounds checking. So like we kind of glossed over, like we have these overflows because we aren't checking our sizes, like talk a little about could we just check them all the time and why don't people just do that? Like why do our C compilers not do that? Because there's been research on making C compilers that check all the bounds. Talking about memory-safe programming languages for that Rust assignment and what they do that prevents use after free and similar bugs, and fuzz testing and sandboxing, and if time, probably some web security stuff. I need to navigate what exactly does and doesn't overlap with 3710, but same origin policy, and cross-site request forgery would probably be the big topics. And I'm tentatively not covering format string exploits, which is often a topic in this course, and that's a deliberate choice. So who here has heard of format string exploits? A few people, not many. Okay, format string exploits are basically that this leads to arbitrary code execution. The reason I'm skipping talking about it, even though that seems like obviously a pretty interesting thing, and often useful is that modern printf implementations make this very, very hard to exploit. So I don't think it's worth covering, even though it's traditionally been a topic. Questions. Okay, so let's go to our first topic, which is the heap. And exploiting things on the heap when we have memory errors having to do with heap. And I'll start with overflows on the heap. In some of these cases, we kind of dealt with. If we have a buffer with a function pointer conveniently located after our buffer, we know how to exploit this now. We just overwrite that function pointer with the address of shellcode if we have executable memory, or the address of the first gadget in a chain of gadgets to run. But we don't often have situations like this. It's pretty rare to have someone write a struct that looks like this for us. What we might have instead is we might have, say, two objects with vtables that are allocated, and we have a buffer overflow where we can go outside of one object into the next. And if these objects happen to be allocated next to each other, then we can actually do kind of the same sorts of exploits we've seen before with things on the stack and so on. That we just figure out where the other object is relative to the first, and then we, overwrite probably this vtable to like point to a kind of fake vtable here, which points to some gadget. That would be a way we could exploit that. So questions on kind of this exploit pattern. So the question is, we know we have this vulnerable code. How do you figure out what this distance is? Someone give me, suggest a way to figure that out. Like, if I've given you a program where we're doing this, and your job is to do this exploit, how do you figure out how far until we get to the next vtable pointer? Yeah. Okay, so we could try looking in the assembly. So the assembly of what?
Assembly of the executable.
So we're gonna have an issue here. So I like this idea. The problem is that we're gonna see basically that we're gonna have a call to malloc, and we're gonna say move the return value of that as our first pointer, and then another call to malloc, and we're going to move the return value of that as our second pointer.
So
this is not an array. This is basically two malloced objects. So you're given this program. How do you figure out how to exploit that? And I would say the easiest technique involves running the program. Like, I think, yes, it is possible to do this by only observing code, but I don't think that's easy. So what would be a practical thing you might do to sort of find where do we put that second pointer? So we can use an experimental strategy. So that's one good idea, is that we can overwrite this much, then this much, and this much, and this much, and see when we first get a crash at a future call to a virtual function in second. And so this is a common idea for exploiting these types of bugs. If you have the program, you just you figure out what you do something, sort of seeing how much you need to overwrite, and look for when do we get the crash that tells us we've overwritten the detail. So we might get some crashes before then, depending on what's in this gray region here. But if we get the crash that indicates we were calling a method on second and that crashed, that tells us we succeeded in overwriting the detail. So that's a very good idea. So the idea I was thinking of, which is arguably more straightforward, is I run GDB and I print first and I print second. And subtract. And we just hope, try to make sure when we're running in the debugger, we imitate how it's going to happen when we actually exploit it as close as possible. And hopefully the distance will match up, because even though we don't know much about how malloc and free and such work, we would expect that they're usually sort of deterministic, that they're not code, which is like getting random numbers all the time and doing something. They're just getting some memory, which is, yes, going to be at a randomized address, but typically it's going to be in big chunks, as we'll talk about later, and they'll have a consistent distance if we're running the same program with the same input. Okay, so questions about that? So you have two kind of ideas for, I don't know what these, I don't really know the memory layout, how do I find that out? One is we can check in the debugger. The other is we can just do stuff that we know is going to cause a crash and look for the interesting type of crash. And as an example of someone actually using this, let's talk about maybe the most prominent example of a heap overflow exploit in the past 5 years or so, which was for sudo. So sudo had a heap overflow bug that was locally exploitable. So sudo, is a program that runs something after you enter a password as administrator, if you are on a list of authorized users. And to do this, it runs with elevated permissions. So it's really bad if it's exploited. And sudo had this very subtle heap overflow, which is in this code here. And the heap overflow is that these two increments will skip, if from of one is a null pointer, sorry, is a null character, they will skip over that in this loop and keep going. So even though from is initially a null terminated string, if it ends with a backslash, then that null terminator will be ignored and it will keep going past the end of that. So this was the bug. And this is a heap overflow because the thing that we were copying to, that's where the overflow would happen, is malloc. And it's malloc in the wrong size because it's based on the size of the string len based size, not accounting for that skipping over the null terminator. So this was the bug, and you can see it's a very subtle bug. And it's not clear that this is exactly exploitable because sudo has sort of all our usual mitigations. And we don't seem to have much control over what's next to it in memory. So the people who did this right up here, Grubb and Qualis, their technique was the experimentation technique. They tried to make a bunch of crashes. So they just triggered this bug a whole bunch of times in a bunch of semi-random ways and looked at how the program crashed. And they just filtered through those crashes to find ones that looked interesting. And they found one interesting crash where the debugger said, oh, we're doing this line of code here. And to give some sort of context here, this is a function pointer that's stored in the struct hook that is being called. So that function pointer call is segfaulting. What happened? We must have overwritten that function pointer. So they concluded that somehow this hook struct, which has function pointers, in this particular case, you know, they tried a whole bunch of sets of input, happened to end up next to the thing that was overflowed on the heap. And they didn't like construct that scenario deliberately, they just tried a bunch of things and looked for a case where you had a crash like this. Now, the question is, how do you exploit this? And a challenge with sudo, and something which made this seem like not such a big deal, you know, kind of initially, is that sudo runs with address space layout randomization. So even if we know exactly where the function pointer is, relative to our buffer, it still seems hard to set the correct value. But they made an interesting observation because they looked at, well, where did this function pointer usually point? And it usually pointed to this function here, and this is where it is in the sudo binary at address offset EA00. We know the way ASLR works, it's going to be loaded at that address plus some big random number. But a function that would be nice for them to call is this execv function. This is runs a particular program. If you've taken CSO2, you may have used this function. It runs an executable. And it happened to be the case that the offset between the execv function and the function that would normally be placed in that function pointer is exactly 6000 hex. And also, these last 12 bits here are fixed because we learned that the way the operating system manages memory, we allocate in these page chunks. You know, that's how memory protection works, so we have to do that. So there's only actually kind of one bit here, sorry, one, four bits here that are kind of different between these two addresses. Typically. And we know that otherwise the other bits are the same because these come from the same executable. We learned the way ASLR works, that we're going to have this big chunk which has our execv and our hook getInv. Like this is all going to be loaded somewhere in memory from the executable. All together. So the trick they did is that they just overwrote 2 bytes of the pointer value. No, so their goal is that assuming the pointer looks something like this, we're going to overwrite these 2 bytes to make it look like that, and the high bits we're not going to change, so we don't care about ASLR for this. Now, the problem is that what's randomized in ASLR is all of these bits. Right, including the A. So it seems like, well, this doesn't work, right? Because we have to overwrite that A, right? We can't just overwrite 1.5 bytes, because we're copying a byte at a time. But their observation was, we can guess about what's going to happen. So their idea is that we're going to guess the address is at something 8A00. And that's going to be right about 1/16 of the time. Because these 4 bits here, these are actually chosen at random. So they'll guess that and just keep trying until their guess is right. And that will take an average of 16 attempts. Or not an average, they'll take around 16 attempts to do consistently. Probably an average lower. Now, it actually was harder in the real exploit. In the real exploit, the way the copying works is it copied a null terminator too. So their overflow actually had to end with 0, 0 here. And they had to write an additional null character. But that just meant they relied on the randomization having to choose zeros for those values, which happened about one in every 4,096 times. And so that just meant they needed to try 4,000-ish times, which is not really a problem when the exploit is you run a program locally. You can run a program 4,000 times locally, you know, in a couple seconds. Questions so far? So this got through overwrite, and so they were redirecting this failed call here to this exact V function. So they turn this to exec v name value hook closure. So to make this useful, they need to have these arguments match up something good, that something useful for the attacker. And the way exec v works is exec v is the first argument is the program to run. The second argument is what argv should be. And they observed that the normal call looks something like this. It was passing the string systemd bypass userdb, the name of an environment, a setting variable for sudo. And that's trying, and if you interpret that as an exec v, it's trying to run a program called systemd_bypass_userdb. So they created a program with that name in the current directory before running sudo. Okay. And so that's an example of kind of a practical, actual, really impactful heap overflow. And you can see kind of the main sort of smarts they used was looking for, you know, a lucky case. They got, you know, just trying a bunch of things and hoping that we get lucky and one of these overwrites something useful. Questions about our sudo example? Okay, so. So this showed us kind of an idea of sort of doing a heap overflow where we, you know, have some lucky adjacent objects and we take advantage of that. And I think that often is a practical strategy. But it's also worth talking about sort of a class of exploits that are kind of more generic than that. And we start with stack smashing. We had these cases where we had like a pointer next to a buffer on the stack. And we exploited that. We had an assignment about exploiting that. But know, often we don't end up with that situation, but we have this stack smashing idea where we have something consistent that we can overwrite, and that consistent thing is a return address. And often we have something kind of similar for the heap, that there's something that's always going to be there, not as always as we might like, but going to be there a lot of the time, so we don't have to do this strategy of try a bunch of things and hope we get lucky and something there happens to be a function pointer nearby. And to talk about that, we need to talk about how malloc works, which is not a topic we really cover in other courses, so I'm going to give kind of a high-level overview of what's going on. So on Linux and most Unix systems, and I think commonly on some non-Unix systems, but with different names, there are kind of two ways to allocate memory. So one way is that we have a heap region. So our traditional program layout, which I believe we cover in CS01, is that we have kind of our code and our globals, and we have our stack, and our stack grows this way, and then we have a heap here that grows to higher addresses, and this is increasing addresses. And historically, the only interface for allocating memory is that we could move this barrier here, which is known as the break, with a system call called brk. And that would be how we allocate memory. And this means that what malloc would be doing in this old design is that when you ask for some space, it would move this break up and give you some part of that space allocated moving up. And when you freed stuff, it would have to find free chunks in that allocated space. Now, these days, we also have other ways of allocating memory. So mmap will create a new allocation somewhere, usually between the heap and the stack on request. In both cases, because of how our memory is managed, these have given us a minimum allocation of 4 kilobytes, and typically a fast malloc implementation will want to make calls to these functions only to allocate like at least 16 kilobytes, probably a lot more at a time. And usually when you call malloc or something equivalent, like new in C++, you're allocating much less than 4 kilobytes. Much, much less. And so a lot of the job of malloc and free is that they have to track of this memory they got in big chunks from the OS, what parts of it are actually used, and subdivide it, and then reclaim it when you free it and give it back to you. Which means that they need some place to store metadata about these objects. And there's kind of, this is a big problem, and something which complicates the problem is that, like, if I allocate 3 objects and free the middle one, we need to track that that middle one is free somewhere. When we call free, we don't say how much we allocated. We need to somehow know that. So we need to have some metadata tracking, and there's kind of 2 common strategies for doing this that are both widely used. So one idea, and the one we'll primarily talk about because it's the most exploitable, is that we say before each allocation you get for malloc, we place this information about, how big is this allocation, what allocations are nearby it, and things like that, for use for doing more allocations or free. Another strategy is that we have a big array of allocations, and we have the metadata before those big arrays, and we have to do some lookup based on like manipulating the pointer to figure out where that metadata is. So the metadata is far apart from the actual allocations. There are some allocators that use this, some of which are pretty commonly used, like jmalloc is the default allocator in Firefox. But, it's not the simplest strategy to implement. And strategy I'm talking about is similar to what the actual default malloc on Linux does. So let's talk about this before each allocation strategy. And I'm going to give, this is not quite what the data structure for the Linux libc malloc looks like, but it's very close. And what we've done here is we have a linked list. So when we have empty space, we keep track of, is that space free, and what's its size, and pointers to a linked list of empty spaces. And when space isn't used, we give you a pointer that doesn't point to the beginning of this, but this is what's returned by malloc points here, points right after the size. So that means when we have an allocated object, you get a pointer to malloc that's just after this size and free information. And the space at the beginning of your object is where the next and free pointers would be, but we don't need them for a malloc object. They're only to keep track of free space. So questions on kind of our notion of our heap data structure, which is just keeping a list of free spaces. And it's a linked list, a doubly linked list, in fact. And that's because we're going to want to add and remove things from the list. And in this example, what we want to do is we want to, when we free this malloc object, we want to figure out to actually sort of mark this whole space as free. And to implement that, we're going to do a bunch of linked list operations. Right, so we're going to want to remove this from the linked list and also adjust this size. Questions on what are free operations doing with this metadata? And so the opportunity we're going to see here is that let's say we have a buffer overflow on our malloc object. What are we going to overwrite? We're going to overwrite that metadata. And that includes two pointers. So this should make us think about our pointer subterfuge pattern, that we can overwrite a pointer, and that pointer is going to be used to access some other data. And in particular, this is kind of what the access might look like, that will probably use that pointer to find the previous link node. So this is my freeing a node from a linked list code. I use the previous pointer to update the previous element's next pointer to skip this list item. And I use the next pointer to update the next previous pointer to skip this item. And what I'm doing here is that this is our pointer subterfuge pattern. This is, if we have our overflow, this is a value set by the overflow. And this is a value set by the overflow. So we have two values the attacker controls, one of which is used as a memory location to write to, and the other of which is used as the value to put there. So we have our pointer subterfuge pattern, and with this style of allocator, we have that for buffer overflows of anything that's malloc. And so this idea is often called heap smashing, because like stack smashing, this is a generic pattern that on a system with this style of malloc, you can use once you know there's an overflow and it's malloc. There you go. Now you know how to exploit it. Questions. So what this might look like So we have our, we allocated a buffer. So here's our allocated object. Then we free the buffer and free something else. So we free the buffer, and free is going to merge these objects. So we're going to remove that from the linked list. And we've overwritten that. And one way we could overwrite that is we make our prev pointer point to the middle of our global offset table entries, like what you probably did for the subterfuge exploit. And in this case, our goal is going to be to overwrite the entry for free, because we happen to have this free call right here that's going to use that entry if we overwrite it. And I'm going to put a prev pointer where if we think about how that maps over the global offset table, it means that prev of next is going to be that entry for free. And that's what's going to be overwritten, you know, first by our linked list removal operation. And it says, oh, I need to set the previous next pointer to point to my next pointer. And my next pointer is going to be overwritten to point to my shellcode, or if we're doing return-oriented programming stuff, the first gadget to run in our chain of gadgets. Or if we're doing something like the sudo exploit, just a function that's useful to run, like system or exec. And then when we have that second free call, it just immediately calls our function. So even though we've probably messed up the rest of the program by editing the global offset table with a bunch of other ways, we don't care because our code is running right now. So questions? This. Okay, so. Okay, so let's talk about this example here. And let's say, so I have this buffer object, which has a vtable pointer and a buffer. I'm going to talk about how can we exploit this situation. And we have a store operation where we can do a string copy that forgets to check whether what we're storing fits in our 64-byte buffer. And my question here, first question is, you know, doesn't matter if the next space after this is free or not. Like, does that change what we should do? Does that change what we should do? And does it make it exploitable or not exploitable? Like, which would we prefer? Would we prefer the space be free after this allocation or not? So who thinks that this is more exploitable if after our buffer A, we have A, and then in increasing addresses we have free space? And who thinks we prefer a different situation where we have some other thing? So who thinks we would want free space after our buffer A? Okay. Who thinks we would want some other thing? Thinks it doesn't matter. Okay, so we have a mix, so anyone volunteering to defend either way, either option? I would say, by the way, I think that both are reasonable things to argue for. I think, yeah. Yeah, so the advantage of there being free space is that we know the layout of the beginning of that free space, what exactly it looks like, and we know that with this deletion here, which is going to be a free, that that's an exploitable arbitrary write. Now, what's the case for we'd really prefer there not be free space afterwards? I think there's a good argument to make that that would be more convenient, even though the free space is exploitable. Yeah. V table points right there. So if the thing after this is any object, there's probably a V table pointer because this is a program that uses object-oriented programming with V tables everywhere, as we can see by having even a buffer class using V tables. So probably if there's something afterwards, it's probably exploitable because we can overwrite the V table, and that might be, you know, easier or just as easy as our idea of overwriting this next and brief pointers. It might be easier in that we have to discover fewer addresses to make it work. Okay. And I think I'm out of time, so we'll probably finish up the next part of this exercise, which is if we know it's the free space example, what do we actually put in the buffer? And then we'll talk about a bit about useAfterFree.